Dinga,
thank you for having us. Can you please start by introducing yourself in full? What's your position also in NUMSA?
My name is Dinga Sikwebu. I'm employed by the National Union of Metal Workers, NUMSA, and my position presently is that I'm the union's United Front Coordinator. And that's the position I've held since February 2014.
Okay, you mentioned the United Front. Can you please take us through that, you know, the circumstances within NUMSA for the start that actually led to NUMSA amongst others, also considering the United Front?
The decision to lead in the formation of a United Front was taken in December 2013 by a special national congress of the Metal Workers Union. And one of the reasons that made the union to take this decision was that when we looked around, we found that communities were struggling around their basic needs. We also found that unions were also taking up campaigns and struggles on the shop floor. The unfortunate part about these struggles is that we were not joining the dots between what was happening in the community and what was happening on the shop floor. And we felt that it was high time that we joined these struggles together, because the source of the grievance is the same. And we felt that a united front would be the best platform to coordinate struggles on the shop floor and those campaigns taking place in different communities.
Now, you mentioned that on the shop floor, you were not really participating, for example, in the community struggles for service delivery. When you say actually there's a commonality, you know, there's common ground, just give us a few examples from a worker's perspective and an ordinary resident in the township. You know, what are the major or the core common grounds that would make it necessary for NUMSA to actually be part of those struggles as well, including, you know, all social movements, you know, being part of those struggles, whether it's in Kagiso or in Gugulethu or Lwandle or KwaMashu, and you name it.
Look, I mean, our starting point as a union is that workers, whilst they spend about 8.5 hours on the shop floor, they don't sleep in those factories. They go back to communities, and issues that face community members also affect our members. And if I give you an example, it's one thing for a worker to ask for an increase of 10% in his or her own wages. But if the rent is increasing or electricity is increasing, those increases eat away what the worker had sort of won on the shop floor. So unless the workers begin to take up issues of rent, electricity increases, then what they've won on one hand gets robbed in the other hand. So it makes sense for us, for workers, to be involved in community struggles and community campaigns, because what they win on the shop floor gets eroded by what happens in the community. Another example, if I may give you another example, is that most of our members are parents. They have kids either in high schools or in institutions of higher learning. So if we don't take up as workers the issues of education, then that affects our kids, And it also affects us, because at the end of the day, if we have to pay higher fees, if we have to pay for books, then it eats away from what we earn.
So these are two sides of the same coin. And unless we have that approach, what we do on the shop floor gets undermined by what happens in the community.
So workers, in general, you know, the working class is also a member of the broader community, you know, impacted by the same issues. If there's power outages, if the education system is failing, you know, it impacts on them. Is that what you are saying?
Look, I mean, that's definitely what we've seen. As the unions have always believed that before a worker is a worker, he is a member or she is a member of a community. Unfortunately, in the last few years, I think the relationship of a trade union organization like COSATU has meant that we haven't been quite active at the level of the community. And maybe this is because we thought that the ANC would deliver, that it will bring up, it will deliver on all the issues. But we've learned the hard way that unless we stand up and grab the direction of our destiny into our own hands, there isn't going to be fundamental change in this country.
Now, Dinga, just quickly, okay. You mentioned, how workers naturally are community members impacted by the same issues that ordinary residents have to deal with in their spaces. Now, let's use this as an interlude to, environmental pollution. We know quite a number of people have been talking, residents in the communities, particularly in the mining areas, they have been talking about environmental racism, for example, how they impacted by pollution from the mining operations and so on, petroleum, you name it, there's a number of them. How does this, you, NUMSA, you also, having members who are working in the mining directly or indirectly, you're dealing with what metals, those metals have to be mined somewhere and so on. Tell me about the health impact on the same communities and workers that we were talking about, how this also impacts, if it does at all, on the gains they make, workers in this case, they make on the factory floor.
Let me start with a concrete example. The United Front structure in Mpumalanga in beginning of November organized a march to Everest Highveld Steel, which is a steel maker in Emalahleni. And what happened is that the community marched to the company, and the workers inside the company marched from inside the company to meet with the community at the gate. And the issue was about a waste disposal site that Highveld Steel dumps its waste in. The first thing about this dump is that when the wind blows, the workers who work in the company and in the surrounding company gets affected by the waste. Secondly, the way the dump is located is that when the wind blows, it blows into the township of Kwakuka. So the workers are affected health-wise because they spend time at work next to the dump. But their kids, their families, their communities in Kwakuka are also affected. Now, this is what we understand as a united front, looking at issues both from an angle of the community and also looking them from the angle of workers on the shop floor. And for us, this was a concrete example of how workers and communities can forge links to fight against elites, corporations, and unaccountable elected representatives. So this is a definite example where both the community and the workers are affected, and that it stands to benefit both groups if they take up the issue jointly. So this is for us is a concrete example, and we are hoping that through the United Front we can have similar examples and similar campaigns where we come together to fight what is commonly affecting us.
Now, it's taken 20 years. I mean, last year, end of the year, basically, you know, there were activities to celebrate 20 years of democracy or freedom. These problems, these social economic rights issues and problems have been ongoing for quite some time. As we know, you know, there's been a number of community protests, you know, linked up to service delivery or failure thereof and so on. How come it's taken so long to actually come to this decision? I'm asking this also against the backdrop of the fact that NUMSA, quite a few years back, had called that the alliance should actually disband. You know, the alliance consisting of, led by the ANC and then COSATU and the SACP and so on, you know. How come it's taken this long to finally arrive at this decision that we need a united front of South Africans, you know, the marginalized, poor communities, or the resourced, challenged communities need a united front?
Let me use a metaphor to answer you. And you will know this, that if you are an orchard owner and you plant an apple tree on the 14th of January, the apples in that tree will not get ripe at the same time. And your task as an orchard owner is not to go to every apple and ask, when are you getting ripe? Your task is to ensure that those that are ripe are picked, those that are not ripe, you wait for them, you cultivate the soil so that they get ripe. Yes, it has taken us so long to realize the necessity to forge these links and to practically act on that. And the reason is quite simple, is that as workers, as a union that's affiliated to COSATU, we had hoped that the strategy of influencing the ANC from within will deliver. Unfortunately, it has not. And this has been a painful realization on part of our members, that what we called swelling of the ranks so that to influence the ANC so that it's working class biased turned into its opposite. Instead of swelling the ranks and influencing the ANC, the workers' organization and the working class become swallowed in the ANC.
Why is that happening? You know, I have to ask this. There was a time when I was covering a COSATU Central Congress. I forgot the year, you know. I asked the same question that we keep seeing, that, you know, leaders in the trade union movement tend to be poached into the NEC of the ANC or into government. And then no sooner this has happened, you know, against the background that, you know, you've... The workers' movement, they sent members, they sanctioned members that are headhunted by the ANC in the hope that they will influence the ANC decision-making processes to actually be more sympathetic to the working class of this country. and this doesn't happen. Why do you think this is the case? Is it because maybe the people you are sending or that get headhunted by the ANC are not politically sussed, abakhabulanga enough, you know, in terms of in-depth political education that informed the struggle and the whole sentiment behind our struggle for liberation?
I don't think that this has anything to do with the individuals. You can take me and put me in parliament and hope that I will deliver. What we've learned is that the system that we have in this country and worldwide is like a big machine. So if you go in there and hoping that you change the machine, what happens is that the machine changes you. So I don't think that it has anything to do with the individuals. It has to do with the systemic nature in which our politics work, where we believe that change can come through parliament, that change can come through delegating power to other people who will act on your behalf. I think that in the last few years, we have lost the idea of a direct and participatory democracy. And I think until we return to this, where people in their streets, in their townships, in their localities, in their churches, in their schools, begin to take direct responsibility of governing themselves, or what in the 80s was called people's power.
Yeah, now
what? If we don't return to that, we can put as many good people into the system. And as I said, the machine will just swallow them up and spit them after that.
Yeah, you're seeing something very interesting, you know, on two fronts. One is how comrades or former freedom fighters got swallowed by the machinery, you know, the systemic system, the economic system, the current economic system. There's also, you know, what keeps the system in place. Obviously, there's a race factor, particularly, you know, in Africa, and in this case, we're talking South Africa. We see the working class, whether they in the same field as NUMSA is in, you know, the working class, the white working class, even where they live, the schools they predominantly go to, there's a huge difference between those and the black metal workers. We've seen this also with the case in at Lonmin, leading to Marikana and so on. Yet we are also talking 20 years into the so-called democracy. Where is the correlation between that machinery that has swallowed up comrades that were deployed to actually make sure that the interest and the sentiments of the working class, particularly the African working class, are being addressed, their aspirations are being addressed? What happened?
Look,
I mean, where are the weaknesses, you know?
I think that there are a number of reasons that can explain the failures of the last 20 years. The first one is that we, for wrong reason, thought that if we demobilize people and we give everything to the leaders, that change will happen. So there's been a sort of widespread demobilization, the weakening of organizations. And although the unions have continued to be organized, but they haven't linked up with the communities. So the first thing is that...
No, I'm sorry, I have to interrupt you there, and I'm sorry to do that. we are from one phase to another. The pre-1994 phase where, you know, You had, for example, the Mass Democratic Movement, you know, UDF and you name. You had the Black Consciousness Movement, you had PAC, all proactive, you know. And then eventually we had the UDF, which consisted of a number of affiliates and so on, you know. There was a lot of closeness with people's struggles, even on the part of the leadership. Now comes post 1994, and in fact we're talking 20 years down the line, you know. And what happened? How come this was let go? You know, that unity that was there, that connection, that strong link and bond that existed between the leadership and the rank and file to ensure that we have a sensitive leadership that listens and cares about the sentiments and the views of its constituencies, in this case, you know, the people that it was representing.
The question of how we understand how we have got to here is a complicated one. But let me just try to make things simple. The first thing is that when you start rewriting history in a manner that makes people not to believe that it is them that liberated themselves, you are starting to undermine their power to change things. So what happened in this country is that in the 80s, in the 70s, it is ordinary people who took up struggle to liberate themselves. Fast forward that to the 90s, people talk about how the ANC and the political parties liberated them. So the people who were agents of change, what they do, they fax their agency to political parties and to political elites. Now this is a very corroding exercise where people begin to think that it is other people who have changed their conditions instead of believing in them. So this started happening in the 90s, where people look to leaders instead of looking at themselves as their own liberators. The second thing which happened in this country is that the distance between the leaders and the rank and file began to increase. And this is understandable because many of our leaders came from backgrounds where they didn't either have some inheritance or accumulation. And therefore the issues of materialism, the questions of accumulation at a personal level began to be uppermost. And as they always say, that the world outside a BMW is different from the world when you look at it through the windows of the BMW. So a social distance began to emerge between the leaders and the rank and file. There is thirdly the fact that what happened is that to be able to get to where we are, we had to make certain compromises. And those compromises were made under the belief that they would allow us to seize political office and use political office to change the economic structure of society. Now, that's easier said than done, because when people got onto the political levers, instead of using those levers to change the economic system, they just got stuck onto those political levers. So 20 years down the line, what emerges is that we are the most unequal society in the world. What emerges after 20 years is that poverty is still rife. And thirdly, that all those who had privileges, whether it's the white community, whether it's the corporates, begin to enjoy the benefits that they enjoyed before the 1994 breakthrough. And this is what we've seen in the last 20 years. And I think as NUMSA, we kept on hoping that by either influencing the ANC, swelling the ranks, joining the ANC, putting people in the parliament, things will turn better. But as I said, we had to learn the hard way that things didn't change, which is why we had to take the decision that enough is enough, and that we do need to take our destiny into our own hands. And the United Front is a step to realize that approach of taking our destiny into our own hands.
It's, you spoke about the corporate world, you know, and our leaders, without making a blanket statement here, some of our leaders got stuck on levels that they were mandated to go change, you know. It is a fact that we did take over. Because, you know, we have a majority black government and so on, you know. So there was some takeover of the office, which was part of the plan. But now this is a takeover. It's only political, you know. You could say, you know, superficial to some extent, you know, because it's on the surface. When it came to the corporate, economic transformation, we spoke about reconstruction and development program and so on, you know. We saw some element of the political reconstruction, if you like, or developments, you know. But as you said yourself, you know, when it came to the economy of the country, you know, the economic health, you know, there wasn't really much shift, which is why, you know, our people, you know, the majority of the people are poor and so on. Now, what actually was the role played by the corporate world? Because I don't have a belief that, you know, when the majority leaders, when they went into the office, you know, to the new political office, or they were allowed, you know, into the seats of power. I don't think they went there with the idea of not changing to better the lives of the majority of this country. Now, what prevented them, including my question of what role was played by the corporate world to change, for example, the likes of Nelson Mandela into abandoning the Freedom Charter?
Look, I mean, as I said, if you take the measures put in place to change the economic structure of this country, we depended on the will of the corporates. What we did, we thought that we could negotiate black economic empowerment charters where the white capitalist class in this country would willingly hand over their economic power. Now, this has not happened anywhere else. Those who have power are willing to open the door for others to come in, but on condition that they continue to be behind the driving wheel. And this is what happened with the economic plans in this country. The second thing is that our government did not deal directly with the way the economy was structured. We have been a minerals-dependent economy, or what we in NUMSA call the mineral energy complex. Now, clearly, to be able to do that, to change that, you need measures to diversify from that. All the economic patterns, all the economic relations with the global world, We kept them as they were. And it was in the interest of those with economic power to ensure that they are able now to list in New York, in London, in Melbourne. So the people who benefited from the opening of economic ties are the same beneficiaries that were benefiting under apartheid. So I think that we had to have a different take on how the restructuring of the economy had to be done. But unfortunately, we didn't do this. We got locked up in the way the things were operating and just continued to drive the car forward. And what it has meant? It has meant that many of our people have been left behind.
Is the fact that African people are in the majority and you have, you know, the white community in the minority, yet having in its hands at the economic muscle of this country, is the race factor playing a role, a huge role, in the lack of change in this country in terms of a real empowerment of black people?
Oh, definitely, yes. I mean, if you look at statistics about the levels of unemployment, if you look at the people at the bottom rung of poor people in this country, you'll find that it's the majority is black people. So in many ways, although we've had a sort of change in South Africa, I don't think that we've been quite strong in challenging white privilege. And white privilege is not as a result of the pigmentation of the people. It's also linked to the fact that those who are classified as white have access to the economic system, have control of the economic system, and have been able to use the skills that they acquired under apartheid to ensure that they continue to benefit in the new South Africa.